Nearly all metal buildings I have experienced or designed have not considered touch sufficiently and have not been designed to be leant against. The machined, controlled line and hard surface aesthetic does not have to be the only product of industrial metal manufacture. Manufacturing processes can give us soft and less controlled surfaces. And choosing materials that allow the environment to change the surface is an aesthetic design decision which embraces not only the appearance, but becomes a metaphor for designing with rather than against nature, for beginning to unwind the long recent past where everything we have created becomes everything to be maintained. Since the Industrial Revolution, maintenance has dictated our environment. While many of our projects have explored improving structural and energy performance to help create spatial environments, one of our other current concerns is illustrated by the cultural greenhouse in Tarascon. It is to create architecture using material which is less and less processed by industry, thereby reducing energy consumption and cost. In Catherine Gustafson's new landscape, we suggested gabions as the basis for both soil retention of the site and the greenhouse, which allowed the simple building of a separate wall and a roof to merge with the landscape, to become one. This project enabled us to contrast raw stone walls with a sophisticated glass roof. As a result, the design is didactic, contrasting differences, the technologically processed and the unprocessed, the energy invested in making glass and the embodied energy in rock, the smooth and the rough, the fragile and strong, the reflective and absorbent, the cold and the warm. The architecture remains as the building changes under light and rain, and as the interstices in the wall become inhabited over time. The deprocessing of construction appeals to me. Directly associated with this is the discovery of beauty in the essence of materials. And I seek more and more to find, understand, and capture this essence in my work. But that beauty can be tempered by awareness and understanding of the social implications resulting from the processes through which the material has passed before it becomes an element in the architecture. Take copper, a noble material. Only through a better understanding of the processes from extraction to coil and of the different quantities of copper ions that run off over time when the copper is left unpatinated or is post-patinated or treated with anti-graffiti coating, and how these ions lock into the mineral surfaces around, can the beauty be fully appreciated. This deeper understanding provides a different design perspective to its application in architecture. Or copper in the form of woven phosphor bronze wire that uses less copper per unit area and the soft tactile qualities that this can give. Or steel allowed to oxidize naturally as with the Corten, first bright ginger and then slowly to burnt red. Steel that is not visually shiny and hard, but has an almost soft quality. Or stainless steel, and a more durable and resistant surface through shot peening, which makes its surface respond softly to the light and the continually changing nature of that light. So how should we design today? The fifth question. Called looking round the corner. Initial reflections on sustainability and design in the late 1970s as a pragmatic search for a clean eco-design methodology has since become, for some of us, a more fundamental inquiry into the problem of design in general and of its re-evaluation in terms of an impending evolution in world views from an industrial reductionist culture to that of a post-industrial holistic one. The question is based upon the assumption that our ecological and socio-economic irresponsibility cannot continue. There are two reasons: the consequences of increasing urbanization and planetary-wide pollution. Therefore, we have to innovate with far more awareness and intelligence. We have to ask ourselves whether we can influence the evolution of design in general, and if so, how to go about it. Despite pretensions to our importance, and certainly the media has played their part in this myth-making, as architects, we rarely initiate new directions. Our power is essentially formal. We are rarely in the very front line to prescribe or determine in any consequential sense the context, use, production, cost relationship, profitability, marketing, durability, ecology, etc., of the materials from which we make architecture. Some of us try, and just occasionally we are successful in influencing an industry or two. Primary decisions on, say, whether housing or education or energy should be given more importance come from politicians responding to the more powerful or politically important constituencies. However, housing type and density, the nature of urban and ex-urban space and development is within our direct sphere of influence. And it is at this point that most of us begin to contribute. A basic redesign of the material products in conjunction with new standards for recycling, toxic elimination, energy and resource efficiency, dematerialization is complex. And as we begin to analyze the eventual transformations in product life cycles and industrially produced materials with the potential for endless recycling without affecting human health and safety, their impact can become positive. It is evident that the criteria for analyzing impact, the capacity to construct a general picture, the language employed in their definition and communication, the methodologies by which to apply conclusions to new design problems are at present far too limited in scope to cope with the problem of global impact and its effect on the quality of life. Repeat, we have to think differently. We have to make our designs not only a positive asset for the investor, but a positive asset for the environment and our collective humanity. A definition of environmentally positive design might be where any manufactured byproduct of the design solution has a net contributing value when analyzed in terms of environmental and social impact. It's obvious that the new intellectual and creative alliances will be needed in our industry and others. The question today is whether we have reached a point of time, culture, space, where we must place our collective environmental well-being more in harmony with nature, or allow our present actions to continue to sustain the status quo. The opening up of our investigation to include a more social, political, and philosophical criticism of design is complex but indispensable if we are to take the redesign of design seriously. And one goal, perhaps, is to open up a critical discussion on the role of design in modern society in view of a re-evaluation of our ethical responsibility as designers. I want at this point to refer to a specific project to highlight some of the challenges that lie in reconciling differing values and objectives. In 1997, a joint team of US and UK retail architectural practices had designed a conventional shopping mall scheme at White City, Shepherd's Bush in West London, for Chelsfield, the developer of the site. This scheme failed to satisfy the planners or the local community. As a result, Chelsfield selected us to lead a design rethink with them. Our approach began with ideas about a new, more integrated urbanism and environment. Working with the Hammersmith and Fulham planning team, this led to an understanding of the potential of how the entire area from Wormwood Scrubs to Shepherd's Bush might evolve, its impact on London, and how this might inform the design and impact of Chelsfield development, acting as a new heart in an expanded town centre. From this, it was clear that improvements to public transport, with additional underground and rail stations, were vital, as well as the importance of creating public urban spaces that had continuity with the existing urban fabric. Introducing more housing and cultural activity was also central to our thinking. We sought to create connections to Shepherd's Bush Green through a landscape along the southern boundary of the site and proposed a continuity of the urban edge with two public squares. The architecture emerged from the concept of a 21st century walled city containing the market square, the agora, or the souk. The contemporary town centre of shops and market stores, a sort of retail cathedral enclosure. The intention was to wrap the development to the east, north and west, while the south would have a permeable edge and integrated landscape, and this in direct response to the existing urban infrastructure and structures. From the outset, we felt that streets reflecting the mineral urban condition but without vehicles, that they should have a continuous umbrella, a sort of community umbrella. This umbrella would keep out the wetness, but not the noise of rain, reduce solar gain, but allow plenty of sunlight and shadows to play within. And in the traditional way, northern market towns use chicanes in their street layouts to reduce wind into their centres, we would use the urban squares and entrance designs to do the same. We also set out to create memorable spaces, the streets, external squares, and a central public winter garden at the very heart of the project, a space for a multitude of activities which local Londoners and tourists would wish to visit and revisit. We imagined verticality to the internal spaces, created by light and structure, with proportion and rhythm. The mineral and tactile surfaces in the street would define its urbanity in contrast to the superficial and meaningless plasterboard stage sets so common among out-of-town shopping centres. We saw no need to air-condition any public spaces, streets or winter gardens, or to hermetically seal the shopping environment, as has been the shopping centre fashion for the last four decades in the United Kingdom. Our collective design ambitions were explained at many public meetings with the support of the planners and Chelsfield, and were vital in gaining the full support of local communities and politicians. Public spaces seemed essential if White City was to become an experience beyond that of an endless internal facade of shop fronts. The scale of White City has the potential to take on board more diversity of uses than currently planned that would create another genuine level of interest. The value of architectural space lies in its ability to define new boundaries, which can allow people to create meaningful and memorable spaces, places. We experience individual spaces, a sequence of spaces, and the nature of their relationships in creating dwelling space. Encourage the organization of buildings around a square or street, and so on until we have towns and cities. I'm aware that space is a continuum between inside and outside, between earth and sky, both physically and mentally. Light is the first material of architecture and of space. It defines inside and outside, surface texture, colour, and allows us to measure space. To complement light, sound defines another layer of space together with structure and its proportion. This definition of space is objective. It is about physical dimensions and does not embody values. Only the designer's idea of boundaries. The dimensions of space are neutral, but space itself is not. And the other concept of space is subjective and loaded with values. It is the reflective transformation of space by people, loaded with their values, that create both public and domestic places. A couple of adverts in Time Out from 2001. You can find them. This raises a profound question. If distance is of less and less consequence as we move around more and more, both electronically and physically, does it challenge the legitimacy or value of an architecture that sets out to make spaces that can become places. Only a century and a half ago, the power of distance to hold us and the power of place to help give us identity were very evident. But we were also prisoners of those spaces and places. The design challenge we faced at White City was how to synthesize and reconcile the different spatial perceptions and values between the architects, client, various retail investment and funders and advisors to the client, and how these would be interpreted subsequently by shop interior designers and the general public. Currently, design is for the most part in our consumer society, a useful tool to enhance sales. It appears largely concerned with redefining and filling space. As architects, we have to imagine and create through our design methodology solutions that could be seen to respond positively to the above, but also to go beyond that produced as a byproduct of functional commercial planning and surfaces that sell. We had to invest in our thinking and design skills in order to make urban spaces that responded to the scale of this part of the city, and also London, and engaged with people's senses so that they can appreciate and get excited about them as places. Through the senses, we reach memory, as well as excite the mind with new ideas. These lead to a sense of community, of new types of communities, of shared interests and ideas, combined with a sense of locality. Too many spaces deprive us of quality sensory experience or have sensory overload by confusing the visual, audible, and the tactile. The making of space is to provide a framework for activity. People turn spaces into places through their activities, communicating a way of life. Architecture is essentially about this exchange and communication. Ten years ago, I ran a program based on the idea of a space before, a space between, and a space after. A project that engaged with transformation over time and cultural imposition. There are parallels with the process of designing White City. In the case of White City, the space before has two characteristics: the local physical and social memory, and the preconceptions of what characterizes a shopping centre, articulated by Chelmsford. The space between is the planning and design part of the process, which we have completed. Here, consideration of the media world, the role of promotion and advertising, and its invasion of the space after is not yet at the forefront of our minds, although strategic approaches have been considered and adopted. We know that the advertising teams and the interior designers will arrive later, and we hope that our architectural spaces are strong enough to keep their identity and character, and to remain exciting and enticing no matter what the changing world of fashion and commerce puts into them. The space after is a much bigger design issue. It is about the creation of future spaces and must be predicated upon flexibility if it is to have any real value to the client. Ideally, this flexibility has to be available at the small scale, the shops, and to some extent at the larger scales of the streets and public spaces. The inbuilt flexibility and potential to respond to future changes is central to a viable investment. Within this context, we try to define the qualities of daylight and artificial light, of soft and hard sounds, of rough and smooth surfaces, and of mono and polychromatic environments. These are fundamental, but above all, we are uniquely placed to provide the vision and to synthesize its architecture. The vision of spaces to come, its underlying structure and character, and its chameleon-like potential. We have had to remind our client and ourselves that memorable spaces are usually exciting, unique, and of recognizable quality. They are spaces that are not static. People move through them as does light, shadow, and sound. They are spaces that are continually changing with time through the density of human activity within them, but do not surrender their intrinsic and enduring qualities. Such spaces have immense potential to attract visitors. In a highly competitive marketplace, the creation of such spaces must be of value not only to the development itself, but also the locality, and in this case, London as well. So we've come full circle. Uplifting architectural space is not in conflict with a concurrent consumer society, for it can attract the consumer and encourages them to return. In one sense, we are maintaining the status quo, but we are also raising broader qualitative expectations, because these spaces at White City will be associated with a more intelligent approach, where natural ventilation, well-designed stations, and express design quality throughout is evident. We all need to go shopping, and concentrating ourselves in cities means that we will always have marketplaces. We can make urban design and architecture have meaning in this context, with streets and spaces that enrich experience. Chelsfield understood and supported this approach, and there is a genuine excitement in producing them. It is illogical and environmentally unacceptable that conventional shopping centre designs allow air-conditioned shops to throw their waste energy through the roof into the sky, despite some degree of inbuilt heat recovery. It is also illogical to design air-conditioned malls, both from an economic and environmental viewpoint, when the shop's waste energy could be put to very good use. The opportunity to use the shop's waste energy to mitigate the extremes of winter and summer temperatures in the internal public spaces, streets and winter garden seem to us reasonable and intelligent. We recognise that our client, Chelsfield, at the time, throughout the evolution of the design, naturally started with preconceptions as to what constituted a good shopping centre design. Yet they embraced the importance of public spaces to the civility of town centres, and that city centre shopping facilities in the 21st century should be naturally ventilated. It is vital that people can see through the design of the streets that they are simply protected environments, so that their comfort expectations match the environment. Any air-conditioned mall has a completely different design environment, and with it comes a completely different set of comfort expectations. The principle of any natural ventilation system is that comfort is achieved for 99.9% of the time, with a tolerance of 0.1%. And our bodies across the planet are used to that. The use of computational fluid dynamic modelling for the simulation of natural airflow has been critical in convincing those involved. Of course, the difference in annual energy use between naturally ventilated covered streets and squares and a fully air-conditioned public environment is enormous. If the White City's project streets and covered public spaces were to be air-conditioned, this would require the roofs to be insulated and completely changed, the energy consumption would increase up to 3 times, depending upon the efficiency of any heat recovery system, wasting up to 2,000 megawatt hours per annum. This is equivalent to adding 500 tons of CO2 into the atmosphere, which is equivalent to 500 Western houses, which don't exist. Exceptional summer external temperatures that London experienced during the heat wave of August 2003, when temperatures were in 33 to 38 degrees centigrade, are in fact similar to regular temperatures in Hawaii, California, or Seville. And in these places, shopping centres, unconditioned, shaded outdoor streets, are common. The ownership of White City has changed recently. We are waiting to see if the new owners are as committed to the urban architectural and urban principles and ambitions supported and promoted by Chelsfield and Hammersmith and Fulham. I come to a conclusion, a reminder of the questions that I set myself at the beginning. I have tried to explain some of my thinking about a new design paradigm concerning environmental impact in a more complete sense, quality and aesthetics in a profound sense, and cultural identity in a politically controversial sense. Architecture is culture, Willem Flusser, the Czech-born philosopher, made a very convincing argument in his short essay, The Factory, that it is through the factory, that is, the place of manufacture, that we can understand the science, politics, art, and religion of a society, and identify the human being in that society. I think his sense of humour suggested that Homo Faber, the maker, was perhaps a better description of the common characteristics of human beings rather than Homo sapiens sapiens. The materials and physical spaces that our architectural thinking ultimately has to engage with is a powerful witness to Homo Faber. But today we surely have to address deeper and more difficult questions if we are to find solutions that respond to Homo sapiens sapiens. We have to overcome the shallowness of much that we do. We design to the laws of physics as we know them. So why are we not designing to the laws of ecology as well? Many observers have suggested that architecture in its classical sense has been experiencing a profound crisis of meaning. I think that during the last few decades in our Western society, discussions in both architecture and art have focused again on meaning and on evaluating the relationship between economics, aesthetics, and spiritual. However, meanwhile, the image has triumphed over content. This new design paradigm that I'm exploring requires us to redefine and expand the criteria for determining whether or not design solutions are functional and meaningful. Functionality is ultimately impact in a world where our goal is the quality of life. Meaning, through human values and visual aesthetics, reveals values within the ultimate art of all, the art of living together on one planet, and will have an indirect impact on how we develop our world. One action we could take for each and every design decision, independent of its apparent scale of impact, is to question its meaning and impact upon the quality of life on a global level. Of course, we cannot expect to answer this with any scientific certainty, but the simple act of asking the question will help us to begin to develop a broader critical sense, along with the new analytical tools and methodologies that will emerge and which are necessary to change the acts and products of design. Life should have an integrated quality of matter and spirit, but we have seen that time itself has been split. I propose that at the workplace of Homo Faber, we demand economy and efficiency, fast time, and we are lost in it. While at home, we should have slower time, time that gives us a chance to regain ourselves. And in between, we have Homo consumeris, both fast and slow time. Art time, however, in its broadest sense, requires art to be, for us to become immersed, and through this immersion for time to be non-existent. Recognizing and finding ways to reconcile the split of time is one of the most fundamental challenges of our age. For without reintegrating time, we have no chance of recovering a wholeness to our lives. And if architecture reflects life as it is, or in Gideon's words, the interpretation of a way of life valid for a period, we have to recognize that time and our mobility are absolutely central to any architectural interpretation. The redefinition of an architectural aesthetic and beauty lies, as I've said, in the non-linear phenomena of nature. Significant parts of this new definition are the transformational qualities of architecture, not frozen images, and a rediscovery of the architecture, not frozen images, and a rediscovery of the spiritual rather than our continued focus on the material, on matter. Martin Wright and Jonathan Porritt, in an article entitled "The Future Won't Be Secure Unless It's Sustainable," argue that a more sustainable world will be a safer and a fairer one because environmental degradation and social injustice are increasingly feeding off each other. If we want to feel more secure ourselves, we should start by improving the security of the poorest. Producing architecture in our society is increasingly constrained by economics, regulations, and I might say, the seductive lure of the media. I hope that what I've covered this evening has addressed in some way the challenge of redesigning design, design that recognises the deep changes in the family unit that have impacted wider society, that industrial behaviour has to redesign itself to make positive contributions to the environment, innovation needs directing towards healthy artefacts. The impact of innovations in information technology upon our traditional ways of thinking about public and private spaces and their boundaries, and that we, architects and designers, must apply a moral dimension to our work. I'm an optimist, and I hope that one day soon we will have a much more cooperative and sharing world. Thank you.